Hello, everyone, and welcome to Jonah and Ben Play Board Games with Friends. I am Jonah, joined as always by my co-host Ben.
Hey, how's it going?
Doing well, and today we are joined by Greg. Greg, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you very much for having me.
Of course, glad you could make it. So, what have you two been up to this past week? Anything fun?
Went to a brewery yesterday for the first time in a while. Sat outside, social distance.
Oh yeah, which
Just a
one?
town in Hightstown, which is just the town over from me. And yeah, it was really good beer. It was a nice setting. Yeah, took all the precautions. Bought a game. My girlfriend and I, Amanda, went there and played Jaipur. Had a nice
Oh,
relaxing
nice.
evening. Yeah, it was a cool time, and it was very refreshing to be able to do that after so long of isolation.
Yeah, definitely. I'm still longing for the outdoor maskless activities. You know, Ben and I actually went disc golfing this past week. We stayed 6 feet apart and didn't touch each other's discs.
I mean, you
But
kicked mine a few times, but just to try and get it out of the basket, it didn't really work. You kicked the basket more often than my disc, but you tried, and that's all that matters.
you're that flexible, Jonah. You can go that high with your leg to kick a disc out of the basket. I feel like I'd pull something if I tried that.
Well, the Rutgers baskets are old
Rutgers
and
baskets are
bad.
low. Yeah.
Oh,
Yeah, they're not high. I said the first time back, because down in Florida, there's a disc golf course that's a pay to play, so it's like $7 a round. And I actually really like it because every time I go back, they make improvements. Like overnight, they poured concrete like pathways up some hills that used to be like these like ramshackle wooden like logs that were like shoved into the ground. And they have a whole set of brand new baskets that are like the nicest baskets I've ever played on. They're like triple layered chains with like a deep basket and like a big rim or a big band at the top. Super sweet. So the first time coming back to Rutgers, I'm like, man, they could use like some new baskets. That would be like a real nice upgrade. But it's still good to have a course close by, so no
Geez, I
complaints.
never heard of pay to play disc golf.
Yeah,
Like
it's
was it?
the opposite of the sport, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I feel
Well,
like it's PGA. Was it PGA's like the National Golf Course? Did it have like a little side off to the main course of the disc golf?
so that no the, this one so this one specifically is on like, oh God, how to describe it? It's kind of on someone's personal. It seems like it would normally have been like a farm type of area, but it's like somewhat narrow and like really long. So like from the road, it's really far back, but it's not super wide. So like the holes go further back, and then right next to it they have like another property that's similar, and it's raised up. So it's kind of like a little bit of like a valley on the front nine, and the back nine is raised up on like the other part of the property. So you walk up to like the back nine.
So it's like some big fairway on someone's property.
Yeah, but I think that the person's property is the owner of the course. So I think they just installed it like where they live. And also, I mean, it's a pro shop, so they have like a pro shop there too, which is pretty sweet because there's not really any disc golf pro shops around here to like go in and buy discs and stuff, as far as I know. So it's pretty cool that they have like a ton of discs just like laying on the walls. And you know me, I like seeing all this stuff, so like every time I go in, I'm like, oh, do I buy something? And I usually do, but
How'd you guys shoot?
well, I took my brother. He'd never played before. This is the first, well, the in
I think
Florida, I
Greg
took
went
my
with us.
oh, yeah, well, just to tell you, I took my brother. He played twice for the first two times. And he's like, oh, you should give me like five strokes, but I'm still gonna beat you. And we played for filling up the car with gas. That was our bet. And I still, even giving him five strokes, I beat him by like 15. So I think I need to give him more than five strokes. But up here at Rutgers, I was three under both times we played, so not bad.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, I haven't played that course yet, but
Oh, you still haven't?
no, not Rutgers, no.
We should go sometime this next week.
Yeah,
Yeah,
I'm free.
In the afternoon. It's
Okay.
a short course, and some of the baskets, the like actual basket part of the basket is like bent a little bit, but you know, It's an excuse for when you miss.
Yeah. The only basket that's deep is 13. Other than that, the baskets are all, like, shallow. Pretty shallow compared to each other. But it's definitely a nice course to have around. And like you said, it's a short course, so.
Mm-hmm. So, Greg, since it's your first time on the show, why don't you tell us all what type of board gamer you are? You know, what game got you in the hobby? What type of games you like to play now?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I've always been sort of around board games. You know, back in the day, particularly collectible card games, started off with Pokemon, middle school, and graduated to Yu-Gi-Oh! You know, slinging cards on top of the trash cans in school. Dabbled a little bit of Magic, The Gathering. Then I took a break, and then around 2011 or 2012, I got super into Magic, The Gathering again. And just through that, going to the game stores and friends' houses, playing games over there, there's always been board games around. And I remember going over a friend's house to play Commander, which is a variant of Magic multiplayer game. And there's a bunch of people there, and they were playing Takenoko, I think. It was on they were playing on a coffee table. And I remember seeing the stalks of bamboo just getting higher and higher. And I was like, what is that? I went home and researched it and started looking at Tabletop, the YouTube series with Will Wheaton, and then found a bunch of games on there. I just discovered this whole new world and been in it ever since.
Dude, Takenoko was the game that got me into board games, too.
You know what? I have not yet to play it, though. I have yet to play it. I couldn't tell you anything about it, just that sparked my interest, yeah.
That's hilarious. Yeah, I played it. I think I said it on our first episode, but I played it in a local game shop that was right by my college campus, because that's when I kind of started getting into it. And we were, as has kind of become the norm for me, we were in the middle of a playthrough, and I walked up to the counter and I bought the game, so.
It was love at first sight.
Yeah, that was kind of the one that got me into it. So right now it's down in Florida. I haven't played it in quite a bit, but it still holds a special place in my heart, and I will not be getting rid of it anytime soon. But I just wanted to cut in with that because I thought it was funny that you mentioned Takenoko. So.
Yeah, and it's funny that I have yet to play it. I mean, it's love at first panda, I guess. It was just something about it being on the table. It was like looking beautiful. Everyone was sort of gathered around.
Yeah, the table presence. That's huge for getting people into new board games. Or for certain board games, at least.
It definitely caught my attention. And when I went back to look what this game was about, I found a bunch of games. And I think I bought Concept. It's like a sort of a party game. Mm-hmm. Charades with icons on a board. That was my first board game. And I like seeing that on my shelf, you know, in my apartment. Something clicked, and I've been in debt ever since, basically.
It's funny that you mentioned Magic. You said that you listened to all of our episodes. Did you like the episode with Jamie talking about Magic? Because he's a big, big Magic fan.
Oh, yeah, that was super interesting. I think drafting was the sort of theme for that episode, and Magic's the perfect example for that. And I thought that was super interesting. Off to play a game with Jamie these days.
Yeah. Do you still play?
Very, very casually. That Commander format that I mentioned before, that's sort of the casual format. I used to sort of be more competitive back in the day, but as I've grown older, I've sort of settled down and become a filthy casual, if you will.
it's a lot to keep up with, any living card game like that or collectible card game like that.
Yeah, I basically just traded one financial money pit for another one.
You can do what Ben does and have multiple money pits.
Yeah, join me on the dark side. Let's see. 3D printing, board games, now disc golf is a money pit for me.
Is RPG. The dark side? Is the dark side in the black, though? Is that in the black? Is that a reference to being in debt? Is that what you're saying, the dark side?
Well, being in the black would mean I'm making money profit. On it.
Oh, it's profit? Oh, see? I'm not good at money.
Okay, join me on the red side.
There you go.
But yeah, role-playing games, soon to be miniature terrain, if I could find the money for it. So
that's a big one.
Yeah, many, many, many money pits on my side. So
I feel like with all the terrain that you're buying, you could probably charge $7 for people to come and play disc golf in your place.
You do have the basket.
I do have a basket. I just need at least 8 more.
Just have everyone play slowly where you while you move the basket around the backyard.
Right? My backyard, which is 10 feet deep and behind 8 other people's houses. That would work well.
It's just a putting competition.
Yeah. I mean, it is heavily wooded, so, you know, wouldn't be so bad.
Mm-hmm. Well, Greg, since you mentioned playing Magic casually and playing Jaipur at the beer garden, what have you played this past week?
So I actually played a bunch of games. I guess the first one I want to talk about, or I think it's the biggest one too, was Terraforming Mars.
Oh, yeah.
The other day. Yeah, I played that 3-player, and it was quite the experience. So I don't know if you guys talked about Terraforming Mars.
We have not talked about it yet.
Yeah, so basically it's everyone plays a unique corporation, and they're trying to do the best to basically terraform Mars through a bunch of generations. And there's 3 parameters. You have to get the heat up, or the temperature up, rather, to a certain number, and then you have to raise it to 14% oxygen, I think. And then also you have to basically build oceans. And once those parameters are met, the game's over, and whoever has the most points, so whoever did better or most efficiently or contributed the most, I guess, usually wins. So
right. So it's basically just, you know, you're working together to try and make Mars a livable place, and then whoever does the best wins.
Yeah, basically. I don't know how livable it is, because I think the temperature that you raise it to is still pretty chilly.
Oh, really?
You might have to put some layers on for sure. But it's a super, super engine building game. There's a huge deck of cards. They're all unique project cards, and you're drafting these, and you're putting them into a sort of a tableau so they can take more actions. The game's relatively involved, though, because although it's a simple game mechanically, like you only do up to 2 actions a turn, it just keeps going around and around. But the options that you have, and sort of the order that you do those in, and sort of managing that efficiency engine, investing into the future turns, that's sort of what gets people. So teaching it might be a little tough, or explaining it to new players, it might be a little tough. But once you get the hang of it, it's a super fun game and one of my favorites.
Who were the other 2 people that you played with?
So I played with my girlfriend Amanda and a buddy of mine, Mark, who I don't know if about you guys, but he's one of these people that just gets games no matter what. He's never played before. Something just clicks. Inviting him over has become sort of, I feel like I'm a masochist at this point, because it's just not fun. Well, it is fun, but he just beats the living out of me. So
it's funny. I think you mentioned that about him before, and Ben and I played a game of Barrage yesterday, which we'll talk about in a few minutes, with our friend Nick, who was on the show earlier. And Nick, I think, always wins our first play of a game. And
I accused him yesterday of watching strategy videos, even though I don't think that's always the case, but I did accuse him officially yesterday of watching strategy videos prior to our playthroughs of multiple games.
Yeah, I don't think Mark does that. I think he's just naturally gifted in life, basically. When he sees a game, it's sort of like, I mean this, if Mark, if you're listening, I mean this in the nicest way possible. He's basically like Rain Man at a blackjack table. It just like clicks. Everything just clicks, and he's just so efficient in his turns. He builds up these crazy engines, and you're sitting there, especially in Terraforming Mars, everybody, you go around and around until everybody passes. So myself and Amanda, I think we're done around the same time. And then five minutes later, Mark built up such an engine that it took so long for him to finish. And it's just really impressive to watch. So.
He should definitely play an intro game with Nick, because Nick is the same way and tripled my score in our game yesterday. So,
yeah.
Yeah, and it's
a big win.
It's nice to play with those people, though, because I guess you play people with people who are better than you, then you learn some things and just get better yourself. But
right.
You know, in the moment, you're like, oh, my God, like, what have I done to myself? Like, why do I bring this upon myself, inviting him over to play games? But it's still a good time.
Yeah. What else did you play then?
I started Pandemic Legacy Season 1.
Again, oh, boy.
With that. So Amanda and I are playing it. We knocked a bunch of games out this weekend. So this is my second time. I did not finish it the first time, though. I played with another friend of mine. We got to, I think, July, I want to say.
Mm-hmm.
It was sort of like, I remember it was yesterday when we stopped playing because I was so sad. We got to a rule. We opened up something. We tried to figure out what it was. We're like, oh, you know what? Let's just figure it out the next time. And then there was no next time.
Oh, man.
So it's nice to be able to start fresh again and hopefully finish this time. So I'm excited about that.
Is Amanda enjoying it as well?
Yeah, I think she is. We played Pandemic a couple times, but you know, this is such an evolving game, like something new every time you play, and it just gets crazier and crazier. So I think she's really enjoying the.
Mm-hmm. It's good that you mentioned that, because we talked about cooperative games last week, and with Pandemic Legacy, you know, even if you play it two-player, you can kind of play it two-handed. So like you each control two characters. Are you guys doing that, or just playing it as two people?
So we're not playing it two-handed. We're just playing one character each. I think for her first time, this just might be easier to navigate. But I do want to explore it, perhaps season two playing.
Oh, season two is so good. I am in the minority. I bring this up every time Pandemic Legacy is brought up. But I think season two was so much better than season one. Just like not even on the same playing field, just so much better. But not a lot of people feel the same way, unfortunately.
Well, I'm excited then, because I have that sitting on my shelf, just collecting dust, just waiting for me to finish season one. So yeah, I'll let you know how I feel too.
Sweet, yeah. I think a big reason that a lot of people didn't like season two as much as season one is season one is Pandemic with the legacy aspect added onto it. Whereas season two is not the same like core mechanics as Pandemic. Like they really twisted the basics and still had legacy as a follow-up. I think people didn't like it as much for that reason. Because it's less like going around and curing things, and it's more a pick up and deliver almost.
Okay, that's new then. That's refreshing.
Yeah, so I thought it was great, and I'm interested in what you have to say after you play it.
I just gotta keep my fingers crossed that I get past July. That's all I want. That's the goal at this point, basically. And then there was one more thing I actually want to talk about. I've been playtesting a game. A friend of mine developed a game. It's fully functional on Tabletop Simulator, and I've been playtesting it for the past couple weeks. It's called Union City Heroes Alliance. And my friend who created this game had a successful Kickstarter. It's based off of a tabletop RPG game that he developed. And it's basically a comic book world.
Mm-hmm.
The RPG is based off of that comic book world. And then the game is sort of an exploration, deck-building, adventure game, I suppose, where everybody plays a unique hero in that world. And you have a unique deck, starting deck. You have sort of special powers, and you're exploring these city tiles that unveil more cards, and there's enemies you have to defeat. It's a really unique game, to be honest. There's a cool mechanisms where, you know, each tile is basically a comic book panel, and there's special panel abilities that you can use. They're very thematic. Each character feels unique, so it's a really cool experience, and it's a cool experience playtesting too. I haven't done that before.
Yeah, that's cool. Have you Have you brought up any criticism or critique? Helpful things? You know, like, maybe this should be this way.
Yeah, I have actually, and that was cool seeing how it evolved. So taking my feedback, but also the other playtesters, I think we had some overlap, and just seeing how the game is evolving as more and more plays get done. Mm-hmm. So it's a cool experience to be a part of, and I'll let you guys know when the open testing, if you guys want to check it out. I think this is like Ben game, to be honest. It like begs for minis. It's huge. exploration.
And he got my attention.
And he'd love to take your money, so.
Oh, he has my attention even more.
Did you get taught how to play it? Because I know that there are two different types of playtesting. There's, you know, the being taught and then you playing it and bringing up thoughts. And then there's the other, which is very important, is you hand people the game and the rule book and then just watch them.
Yes, I think that's the next phase that they're going to do. This one was getting people on, and the designers were basically the moderators during the game. So they would teach it and sort of move things around for the first couple of games. The next phase that they're going to do is going to be the blind play testing, where they're just like, here you go, figure it out, and then go from there. But it's been really cool. And I have a couple more play test sessions coming up, so I'm excited to see the changes that they made and, you know, the new enemies that you have to fight. So it's a pretty cool game.
Awesome. Ben, you want to talk about what you played this past week?
Yeah, sure. You and I, as we mentioned briefly, we played Barrage. Do you want me to go into Barrage, or would you like to do it? Because I have another game as well. So,
all right, you do your other game, because I was only going to talk about Barrage.
All right, my other game is Dungeons & Dragons. So we had our session again this past week, and honestly, not to toot my own horn here as the DM, but I feel like I'm getting better and better at it, and... Mm-hmm. I mean, feel free to disagree with me, not that I'm telling you to agree or disagree, but I personally feel like I'm getting better at it, and I think that story-wise, this past session, I really started to put it all kind of together. Not that that sounds great as a DM, I had a plan, but, like, I feel like I'm getting better at weaving the story into just the game that we are playing, and I was able to finally end on a natural cliffhanger, which I haven't had the chance to do, because I always end up going a little bit long and then people need to wind down the game themselves. But I was able to finally end on a natural cliffhanger, and it felt real good. So
how much time do you spend sort of after the session, like you go during the week and developing your story, clients and sort of scenarios, like how much time do you put into it?
So I don't really keep track of like the amount of time, but what I do between sessions, and this is actually something that I got from Patrick. He sent me an email, like a really nice in-depth email, because Patrick runs our when I play, he runs our non-D&D RPG games most of the time. And he sent me like this really good email with tips on how to do it, because this is the first time I've ever like DM'd a campaign. And he was like, what you want to do is kind of come up with a framework. So what I try and do is, like, based on the ending of the last session, I'll typically sit down when I have the time, and I will come up with a few little branches of the story that can happen, and say, like, if the characters do this, bring this into play. If the characters do this, bring this into play. And what I've been trying to do is kind of bring in a little bit of the backstory that each character gave me before we started the whole campaign. And mm-hmm. I try and weave that in a little bit to these branches and see where we go.
So you kind of make a bunch of branching paths for the story that you're coming up with. And depending on which path we go down, you already kind of know which direction to take us then?
Yeah, so I literally just have, like, the most brief outline possible. So, like, for example, in the first session, I knew that I wanted to push you guys in a certain direction. So I started with that, but then I was like, oh, if they go down this pathway, I can have bandits appear, which is what happened. But then I had, like, oh, if they go down this pathway or in this direction when they're going to explore this continent, it's possible that like this encounter would have happened instead. So I have some encounters that I have in a spreadsheet ready to go. So like if we hit a certain like requirement type of deal, I can bring that in and be like, oh, this is what you're fighting now. So
have you ever been absolutely thrown off though with what people decided to do?
Yeah. So I think the most famous one so far is before we started, this is a complete homebrew campaign. So for those listening, a homebrew campaign is something that is not official Dungeons and Dragons like lore or world. So I'm taking bits and pieces of the official lore in terms of like the gods and things like that, but it's a completely new world that I made in like a map making software and whatnot. And I didn't create anything below a certain point. And the very first session, Jonah in game actually wanted to go south, and we were already at the bottom of the map. So he wanted to go south, and I
Know it was the bottom of the map,
yes,
though.
He didn't know it was the bottom of the map. And since then, I have potentially, I'm leaving things open-ended, but I've potentially come up with more that is south. But as of right now, in the story that they know, there's nothing south at the moment, and Jonah wanted to go south, and I was like, please, for the love of God, don't go south.
So did he fall off the world and die, and he had to create a new character? Is that what happened?
No, I had an NPC that was giving them their quest that kind of nudged them east because something had happened in the east. So I was like, nudged them to the east. So.
Gotcha. It's really, I really admire the DM's role because being able to think on the fly and alter your plans and sort of.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot more reacting than I anticipated, but I like it. Like, I'd never done it before, but I was like, oh, I kind of want to do this. So, I don't know. I'm really, really enjoying it, and I think I'm getting better at reacting. There are definitely points that I know I'm not great at. Like, I still think I need to figure out better methods of, like, killing time during travel, because I don't really know what to have you guys do in the group during like a travel session where it's like, oh, this could take like a week to travel across the land. Like, I don't want to waste your time with like mediocre little mini encounters the entire way, but I don't really know what to throw in, and that's right. Like a point that I want to improve, because it's also not fun for me to say, okay, you travel for about a week, nothing happens, now you're at your destination. Like, it's not like the world is empty. I just don't know what to do that wouldn't essentially just slow you down to the point where it's not fun. So I need to find that balance, and I know I need to work on that. But outside of that, I think it's all getting better. So that's all.
Yeah,
I think
it's going well.
And last question on that, though, do you do different voices, though?
Nick has a great character voice.
Yeah, Nick has a great character voice. Jordan has a great character voice. I tried like once or twice, but I can't really do voices very well. So like most of the time I just change the pitch a little bit. Like, I'll go a little higher, or like I'll go deeper, but like I can't do like accents and stuff like that. It's not good for me, and it would take people out of the game with how bad it is. So
at least you put some effort though. That's all that matters.
Yeah. But, I think the weirdest part for me is if I'm role playing an NPC that's a woman and I'm just talking in my normal voice. But you know, it is what it is. I'll get better as time goes on. But we've only done 4 sessions so far, so you know, it's still early. So we'll see what happens.
All right. Well, then you want me to talk about Barrage?
Yeah, go for it. I mean, I'll have thoughts to throw in while we discuss, but feel free to introduce it.
So first I want to just ask Greg, have you played Barrage?
I have not, but actually this is a game that was on my radar. For the last couple of days, it popped up on various sites and stuff and recommendations. So
yeah, I also have it as their like game of 2019.
And I also noticed it's one of the designers, actually that we're going to talk about later, Simone Luciani is involved, so I'm already interested in that.
That's right. All right, so Barrage is a game about water flowing down mountains, and you are making dams and catching the water and then building powerhouses and conduits to send the water through some pipes and get some energy. And there are a few ways to make victory points out of all of that. But what's interesting in this game is that it is a worker placement game. Everyone starts with the same number of workers, and then there are a lot of worker placement spots on the left side. And a lot of the spots, if you go there sooner, are better. So like there's a spot that gets you +2 energy when you take the production, and it costs you, I think, 3 workers. But then if you want to take that action later in the turn, it costs you 3 workers +3 money. So a lot of the spots can be taken twice, but going to a spot second is very punishing. And Barrage is a, I think, just about no luck game. I mean, there's some like random contracts that come out, but it's very much a game that looks up my wheelhouse. There's a ton of player interaction because you really care where everyone else goes the entire time. There are contracts to fulfill, which I really like, from Clans of Caledonia. And there is, what else is there that's really neat? There's some wheels that are neat. And the wheels in it remind me of Terra Mystica, because you can build something and you put those resources in this wheel and that technology to build this type of building in the wheel. And then you rotate the wheel one click. And what's really interesting about this is you don't spend those resources. They're just locked up in that wheel until the wheel spins back around and releases them. So I thought that was a really neat take on spending resources to build stuff. But I have a huge complaint about the game, and that is that there are, I think, nowhere near enough ways to get more of these resources considering how you have to use them.
Yeah, I agree. I think we were all agreeing during the game as well. Like the machine shop, for example, if you want to, yes, it obviously it makes thematic sense that you need more excavators to dig in the mountains, but you start with 6, and every trip to the machine shop, you can only get 1 excavator. So you're killing 4 turns because you need 10 excavators to dig certain pipes in the mountains. You're killing 4 turns potentially to get those excavators.
Right, and the first time you spend those excavators to build it, it's going to cost you 5 of your 6 up there, maybe. And then those are just gone for 4 or 5 rounds. And you can, like you were just saying, spend 4 rounds to buy enough to do it. But then, it's, I don't know, you're spending a lot of time trying to accomplish some things, I think.
Does that make the game more tense, though, in your decision-making? I know some people like that sort of tightness of a game where they're restricted in that way. Does that actually have a positive outcome?
So I was actually, I don't know, I did very poorly at this game, and I would like to play it again because there are a lot of really neat things in it. I just want to talk very briefly about something before I answer your question. In this game, you can play as one of 4 different countries, and with that, each person will get a like master planner. I forget what the actual term is, but each country has a special ability that is unlocked after their 3rd powerhouse is built, and each master planner guy or girl, whatever they are, I forget their name, also has a special power. So there's some really neat asymmetry in this. But to your question about the tightness, I actually don't like how this game does it. And I was, you know, I went on a bike ride this morning, and while I was riding, I was thinking about how to compose my thoughts on this game. And, you know, I hate having to bring up the same game over and over, but I really like Food Chain Magnate because every turn matters and you care about what other people do. But the difference between Food Chain Magnate and Barrage is in Food Chain Magnate, the game itself is not trying to kill you. So in Barrage, the resources are super tight and you can make a mistake on your first turn, but it depends on what other people do in Food Chain Magnate for that to be a mistake. So in Food Chain Magnate, you can make a bad hire turn 1, but if someone else makes a bad hire turn 1, neither of those are bad hires anymore because you're fine. But in Barrage, you can make a poor move on turn 1, and it is purely based on how the game works that is a bad move, not just what the other people do.
Yeah, like one of the players in our game built a dam in the mountains, which is more expensive than anywhere else, and that was on turn one, and it really hurt him for the rest of the game, I think, because at that point it was like a sunk cost, and he just dove into a very expensive engine at that point and couldn't really recover. I mean, he ended up tying with you, Jonah, I think, in overall score by the end, but...
Which is a testament to how poorly I did, because I had a better first move.
Yeah, but also, I think once we realized what the end game objective was, and in our game, the end game objective, which I believe is random, because there's, like, cards for it.
Right. Random from the setup.
Yeah, random from the setup. Our end game objective was to build dams or powerhouses in the locations where you need to spend extra money to build them. I don't really know how to describe that spot on the board, but you need to spend extra money to build in certain areas on the board, along with those actions that you mentioned earlier. But I think the only reason that he really came back was because he basically just killed his last couple of turns just spraying buildings into the expensive areas. Not because he was... And this is going to make it sound like I don't like the way he played, which is not the case at all. So, Jamie, if you're listening, that's not the case at all. But he was essentially just spraying buildings into the expensive locations to pick up the extra 15 points at the end of the game, which is a valid way to play because that's an objective. But it just goes to show that the first turn meant, like, by the end of the game, he was really just playing for an objective as opposed to, like, playing with the systems in terms of like moving the water and creating power and things like that, if that makes sense.
Right. I also thought that the game was really mean, which is fine, and I'm fine with mean games, but it felt like a lot of times you were doing something purely to steal something from someone else, and it kind of felt meaner in this than in a lot of other games where you do stuff to beat other people. And the movement of water in this, you know, if I want to harvest this water with my conduit at a dam, you know, I can make the water flow down the mountain until it hits this dam. But it happened in this game that we were all kind of working in the same spots that, you know, I'll make this water flow down, and all I did is set up the next person's turn. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't kind of do the two things in a row that you want, and I could never have the water that I wanted, because the only way I could get it to go down was to get it to stop at someone's higher dam.
Yeah, and not on that point, in terms of moving water to specific dams, not to say that Nick's player power was OP or anything like that, but I kind of think his player power was a little OP. And yes, he set himself up well to use it.
Right.
But Nick's player power was that normally in the game, when you're generating power, you can only take water from one dam, like one lake that's created by a dam. So when water builds up in an area being held back by a dam, that is the only location that you can generate power from. Nick's player power allowed him to generate power from two different dams. So he was able to generate a lot of power from one location and then steal water from somebody else in a completely different location on one action, whereas we would have needed to take two actions to take both water sections. So I think it was yes, again, he played super well. So he was able to get to that point. But once he got to that point, he was just taking water from all over the map and was able to do it before other people were able to do it, because he could just take it out from under you and then take his own water later. And it kind of felt a little OP to me, but...
Right. Hey. Yeah, Nick definitely figured it out from the start and really set himself up later. And one thing I mentioned in this game is it's a game where you want to do this, to then do that, to then get these resources, to then get those points. And if you mess up one of those first three things, your whole tower of possibilities just kind of falls apart.
Yeah, so I definitely agree that the tower can kind of fall apart on you. Like Nick was saying when we were playing, you kind of need everything to hit at the perfect moment. You need the right amount of resources, the right amount of workers, the right spots open at the perfect time to really maximize what you're trying to do. And it's difficult to get all of those things to align because obviously there are three other players trying to do the same thing. And it's definitely super easy for everything that you've planned to just kind of fall apart if one of those things comes out of whack.
Right. It's a tight game that doesn't really allow, in my opinion, which is based off of one game, and I do want to play it again, but it's a tight game that seemed to not really allow for flexibility in your strategy. So, you know, I'm fine with tight games where every turn matters and you really have to be careful with what you're doing. But the fact that you couldn't really pivot if someone took your spot or someone took what you needed, it just, you know, it affects every future turn of yours.
Yeah.
When you guys were talking about, you were talking about meanness, Jonah. Is there a difference in this game being mean as opposed to your favorite food chain magnate where you're undercutting someone's burgers? Like, what's the difference? Because you said this one is a little bit mean for you.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think those are the same type of meanness. And that's what I was trying to figure out why I wasn't as high on this as I anticipated being. And I think it's just the fact that the game is mean to you as well. Like, I enjoy using the game system to beat my opponents. I do not enjoy trying to beat the game system to then be able to use the game system to beat my opponents.
Oh, it's interesting, man. Yeah, that's a good point. I never really thought about it that way.
Because, like, in antiquity, which we talked about before, like, everything you do is awful. And you, like, hate everything the game does to you throughout the game. And, like, it's fine. And you can... A lot of people really enjoy antiquity because part of the game is trying to figure out how to be good at the game. Not good at beating other people, not better than other people at the game, but actually good at the game. And I don't like having that barrier to being able to play like against my friends or with my friends. I should say with my friends.
So you're saying you like when the meanness is a byproduct of being or doing well at the game as a whole.
Right, because like if Ben does something mean to me, that's fine, and he did it to try and win, hopefully. But if the game does something mean to me, it's just like, well, then why am I playing this game? The game is the mean person, which I don't like.
Yeah, that makes sense, yeah.
I want to appreciate someone's good move that I didn't think about that beats me. I don't care if it's mean, because it's, you know, probably the right move and the smart move. But when it's the game doing it to me, you know, whose abilities am I appreciating at that point? Besides my own inability.
I think it's the designers at that point. Designers, for sure.
Right. And, yeah, and go on, Ben.
I was just going to say, I agree with you there. And I think, like you said earlier, it's just so hard to pivot in this game. I feel like I would be more inclined to be okay with like the game being mean on top of the players being mean if it was somewhat more feasible to pivot.
Right, and like what you were asking about in Food Chain Magnate, Greg, you know, if I undercut you or do some other strategy, like, you can pivot and try something else. You can try and add some houses to the map. You can try and make a new type of demand. You can do all these different things to pivot from what I did. But when the game and the other players are working against you, I didn't feel like I was able to pivot. But once again, I've only played it once, and I was not good at it.
And I would really, so just not, it probably sounds like we're being pretty negative on this game. For me, I really liked it. Like,
yeah,
this
I thought it was super neat.
Yeah, this is the type of game that I like. I don't really know how to explain it, and I think maybe the way Jamie described it is probably my best idea of games I like. I don't, I wouldn't say I like games with a lot of rules overhead, but I like crunchy puzzle type games where you do need to unlock the game to play the game, if that makes sense.
We're going to have to bring back the peanut butter scale.
Yeah, I would say that this one is a high crunch on the peanut butter scale.
Yeah, like, this is just a jar of nuts. Yeah. You have to make it into the creamy peanut butter.
Yeah, this is high crunch on that peanut butter scale for sure. But
not even harvested yet, right?
Right.
Yeah, this game to me, and it's kind of crazy because I have played games that are as crunchy, but I would say that this one is like eating peanuts with the shells still on.
Right. And the other thing, you know, Greg, I definitely want to play it again, and I know Ben does as well, and I would happily play it with you. I don't think you would like this game, only because every winning move for you is solely taken to beat someone else to something. And I know that you've said in the past, you don't like to take those mean moves in games. That's like all you can do in this game is take mean moves, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I'd still be interested in trying out because I want to see if I attribute, you know, this game to sort of my outlook that you just explained. You know, the meanness, I've been really doing some soul searching on this because when I play Magic, it's a especially in a competitive one-on-one format, it doesn't matter to me. Like, I could be mean because it's really, I have no other choice. It's one against the other. But when you're in a multiplayer format, especially that Commander one that I've alluded to a couple of times, more casual, everybody's kind of doing their own thing, trying to make big plays and do cool, you know, play with your cool cards that you normally don't get to play with. And then you do something mean to that. It's like something about it rubs me the wrong way, even though everyone has signed that social contract to say, make that best move possible. If it comes at the other person's expense, so be it. That was the correct play. But yeah, it just feels bad to just mess with somebody, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah, I totally, go on.
That just, you know, was working hard just like you to build up their engine or get all these resources. And then, you know, I just like, oh, now even this is the best move for me, but I felt bad. Like Terraform Mars, I removed a bunch of your planets. Like, it feels bad.
Right, and I think I might have mentioned this on the podcast before, but, you know, when you play chess, like, it's not mean to take someone else's piece, because, like, that's how you win. And you know when, you know, I've never played someone in chess, and they took a piece of mine, and I felt like they were being mean to me. But in a lot of board games, sometimes other people's moves feels mean, and I'm trying to figure out, you know, what is the difference between those two things? Because someone taking my piece in chess, whatever, that's the game we're playing. But someone taking my spot in a worker placement in the turn before me to spite me and stop me from getting some points, it just feels a little worse.
Yeah, I've been trying to figure it out myself. Like, what is the difference between, maybe it's the choice, maybe it's, you know, you don't have a choice in chess. Like, that is just one-on-one, that's the nature of the game. But when you have multiple options and there's other people to maybe mess with, mm-hmm. You feel a little bit more targeted, even if it's the right play. Like, there's some underlying aspect of just like, damn, you know, feels better.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not to say that I don't enjoy some mean games. Like, you know, Food Chain Magnate, you know how I feel about that. I still want to play that because I think Mayim's not good at it at this point. Mayim's just being a wuss in terms of just like...
Greg, let's play it together. Let's play it.
Yeah. Yeah, I would like that. Yeah, we can, you know, hype each other up and give each other compliments and all
that. Yeah, for sure.
Sunshine and rainbows. Yeah, we're not selling hamburgers. We're selling like rainbows and puppies and stuff. But.
Yeah, because again, I've said it before. I have yet to end up. I think I've ended up once now within $50 of the next last place person. So I'm not good at Food Chain at all. So let's do it.
I think actually, I'm now that I know the correct term. I think I was in the red. I think that's how bad I was at that game. But that's the nature of it. Like, that's how mean it is, and a lot of people love how cutthroat games can be. And you know, when you come up to the table and you agree to play this game, like, that's just how it's going to be.
Yeah, and I think what we're doing now is kind of making the point that I want to make, which is we're bringing up a bunch of other games while we're talking about Barrage. And for me, what I've decided is I like this game, but there are other games I owned that are a similar crunch level that are better, in my opinion. Yeah. Like Tricarion. And that's what I said immediately finishing this game. This game is a puzzle that I really enjoyed trying to solve, but I enjoy the puzzle of Tricarion more. And if I'm going to play a game that's this weighty, I'd rather play Tricarion.
Right. And I similarly felt like this reminded me of Terra Mystica, but I enjoyed Terra Mystica much more than this. And it's what I mentioned before and what I mentioned during our game. You know, Smartphone Inc. I thought was a really neat game and a cool design. It just reminded me of Food Chain. And why am I going to play that if I could be playing Food Chain?
Yeah, 100%. Plus, I'm basically obsessed with Tricarion at this point. So anytime I get the ability to play it, I'll take it. So.
Ben, tell us all about Kickstarter.
Sure. I feel like I've mentioned this game a few times already, but I swear to you, I've never seen a game move this fast through production. But Rat Catcher, that solo game that I keep mentioning about catching rats with cheese, they've produced the game at this point, it seems like. They have a ton of photos. They've created this rat cage to hold all of the little rats. They've created punch boards. They have all of the plastic pieces created that were extras in the campaign. They have done so much already. It's pretty crazy. So I'm really looking forward to that one. And based on the photos, it looks great. The next game that I want to talk about really briefly, I think I mentioned it last week, possibly, was Tidal Blades, but we're finally winding down on the Tidal Blades saga. And Tidal Blades was a game that I saw at PAX Unplugged 2 years ago at this point, and I had backed it back then, so it actually funded in November of 2018. But basically, they're trying to be nice about the shipping in terms of packing the game well, so they delayed it slightly to try and pack it better, because they were sending out review copies, and the game box is almost the size of Kingdom Death. It's like a thinner Kingdom Death box, so it's huge. Mm-hmm. And the corners were coming indented, and there were dents in the box, so they redesigned their mailing system, I guess, inside of the packing box to protect the corners and all of that stuff. So they put in a slight delay to unpack the games from the pallets, repack them so that they were more secure, and now they're in the process of repalletizing the game so that they can finally send them to us non-reviewers. So
that sounds like a bit of a logistical nightmare.
Yep, just a bit. And I mean, it is a bit of a pain since it was so close to shipping. And it's already a 2-year delay, but it is what it is. I'd rather get a game in good condition than a game that's dented to all hell. You know what I mean? So, oh well. But yeah, those are my two big updates. So,
I have a very small Kickstarter update to report, and that is that QE, a game that I backed earlier this year, has been delivered, and I think it delivered quickly / on time. It was delayed a few weeks, right, Ben?
Yeah, I think it was delayed a couple of weeks, but nothing major in terms of normal Kickstarter stuff. It was pretty minor, so.
Yeah, and also I don't really care too much about board games being delayed right now because I am not playing in person, so
yeah,
not a big deal. Anyway, super excited to play QE. It came in. It looks great. And I mentioned it before, but QE is an auction game where everyone has an infinite amount of money. But if you spend the most money throughout the game, you are automatically disqualified from winning. So it has some neat social elements to it because you're trying to see how much other people spend. and I'm looking forward to playing it in person instead of on Tabletop Simulator.
Yeah, and I'm sure that the actual game is probably much better than the garbage mod that we used on Tabletop Simulator.
Yeah, that mod was no good.
Yeah, for sure.
Greg, are you backing anything on Kickstarter these days, or have you had anything be delivered recently?
So I'm backing the Fuzzies. That's my most recent one.
Oh, no, you went for it?
Yeah, I am. The fluffy little colorful balls drew me in. You know, there's the same people from Wavelength and Wolfgang Barsch from the Mind. And this is only $20. It looked fun, sort of fuzzy ball Jenga, I guess. And
that's the whole game right there, right?
Yeah. So, you know, those three words, that's all you have to say to get me hooked.
Fuzzy little balls?
Fuzzy ball Jenga.
Fuzzy ball Jenga, yeah. Yeah, not those ones. Yeah, for $20, you know, I feel like that's worth it. Just have some silly fuzzy times, you know.
Mm-hmm. Anything else from previous backings being delivered or coming soon?
Yeah, you know, I'm really excited. And this is, I think Ben's going to enjoy this too. The Mayday Crokinole board, I'm really looking forward to. Hopefully that comes later this year.
Sweet. You can join the Crokinole Club with me and Ben.
Yeah.
Sounds exciting. The Crokinole board was something like, it's like a white whale to me because I wanted one for so long. I love the sort of, the concept of just sitting around flicking a wooden disc, you know, having a beer, just relaxing on like a Sunday afternoon. It's something very
or,
like
or classic. Morning, depending on who you are.
That's right. Morning. Yeah. Any time of day. It's just a versatile game, but maybe not the size. Maybe that's doesn't make it as flexible, but
right.
Yeah, I'm just super excited because I've been wanting one for so long and I can't wait for it to arrive.
Cool, yeah. I think it's great that Mayday is making a affordable Crokinole board because that is one of the larger complaints. Like most Crokinole boards are like handmade artisan boards that are like $300+, and it's really nice that someone got into the game that can make it more affordable for people because it's such a good game. I love it.
And the only other thing that I'm sort of thinking about is the Wormwood gaming table. And
yes.
I have...
Do it.
There's 47 days to go, so I have some time to think about it, but still, I'm...
The longer you wait... Honestly, my thought on this, and this is me being like, the way that I normally am, the amount of slots that they keep having to like push back, I would just put in the deposit now and then decide, like put in money so that you hold a slot. Because Nadia, one of our friends, Nadia, was looking at a table. And when I first logged in, I was close enough to get, I was very close to getting a deposit down. Not that I've ended up buying it or was, but I was trying to decide. I ended up getting a deposit down for the January wave, which was the very first wave, January of 2020 or 2021. I'm sorry. And by the time Nadia got on like 15 minutes later, they were at like September.
Well, I know your stance on spending money now, cause in 2 years, like it never happened basically. So
yeah.
I guess, yeah, if I just subscribe to that philosophy, then I'll go for it.
Yeah. But honestly, that Wormwood table looks really, really cool. And I think as someone who does own a game table, I do think it makes a difference. I don't use it as much as I would like just because it's in Florida and I haven't had people visit very often. Of course, with the pandemic going on, not many people are traveling as is. But I definitely do think that it has made a bit of a difference. And what's really cool is like right now, there's a puzzle that's partly done that's set up inside of the vault area. And I put the top on and we play games on top of the puzzle. So it's just really cool to like leave that set up there.
Yeah. I have a lot to think about then.
I still have my eyes set on a Wrathskeller's table that I'm going to get someday when I'm spending stupid amounts of money on a unnecessary item.
I know. I need a place to put my Crokinole board. So, I mean, look good.
And the $15 square foldable table from Walmart doesn't work, right?
you know, the really nice, the maple wood.
It doesn't match the wood, Jonah.
Yeah.
That plastic doesn't match the wood. Come on.
Sorry, guys.
Greg, I do have to ask, because I know that you are, and this is just hopefully brief, but I know that you are a fan of level 99 games. Did you back Bullet?
I did back Bullet, yeah.
I did as well, so I was just curious, yeah.
Yeah, and I know we talked about playing that on tabletop too.
Yeah,
so.
I'd still like to give it a shot sometime, so I definitely am down to give that a go. So yeah, that's another one that looks pretty good from the photos they keep posting, so yeah.
So Greg, as the guest host this week, you were able to choose what game we are talking about. What did you choose?
So I chose one of my favorite games, and one of the games that really solidified me into the hobby, I would say. It's The Voyages of Marco Polo. This was designed by someone we just mentioned, Simone Luciani and Daniela Tascini. Those guys also had a hand in other favorite games of mine, so Tsulkin, Grand Austria Hotel.
Yeah, Tsulkin.
Takenu, actually, I'm coming in the mail, too, as well, in a couple of days. We played Lorenzo from them the other day. So two of my favorite designers. It's a dice placement game. Plays in about 40 minutes on the two-player side, I'd say. It's about an hour and a half, maybe, four players. So 2 to 4 player range. And you're basically playing as a character in the Marco Polo universe. Everyone has a unique asymmetrical ability, which is one of the things I really enjoy about it, too. And you roll dice on your turn, and you're using those dice to take actions on the board, whether you're getting resource or goods or resources to fulfill contracts, and then you get more resources, and you move around the board and plant trading outposts, and those will give you points based off of sort of secret route objectives in the beginning of the game. So there's a variety of ways to get points, but it's a dice placement game. And played over 5 rounds, which makes it super tight. You probably only get, like, I don't know, 15 to 20 actions per game, I'd say. And the pip value is what dictates sort of the power level of the action that you're taking. And it just allows for more variety. So if you do roll poorly or you roll really great, you know, there's always something for you to do based on what's going on during the game at that point. So that is the game of the week.
Yeah, and I've played Marco Polo a time or two, and I really do like the ability to use your lower rolls, because one of my problems, and I mean obviously everyone's problem with dice, is the randomness, which is, you know, the feature of dice. But, you know, sometimes you really want a 6, but in this game you're happy with 1s and 2s and 3s. And I really like that there's a use for those numbers in this, so you don't feel bad when you roll poorly, because they're actually not poor rolls anymore.
And that's something actually I wanted to talk about too, is you mentioned randomness. But one of the things I like about this game and other sort of dice games or dice placement games is the ability to control that randomness in a way. So right. Even though you roll poorly, you still have the flexibility to adjust that roll, maybe by a couple pips or re-roll the die completely. So in my point of view, the randomness is a nice part of the game, but the ability to control that randomness just makes it even better.
Right, and I forget, I haven't played in a bit. It's you spend camels to change the number, right?
Yeah, so there's a resource called camels that allows you to re-roll. So you spend 1 camel to re-roll, 2 to adjust the pip value, and 3 to actually basically get an extra die that turn too. So adds more randomness, but you can still adjust that die as well. And I love the control that you have basically. Mm-hmm. When you roll, all right, I rolled poorly, but I still have the ability to work with it a little bit. I'm not totally screwed.
Right. Can you tell us a little bit about the people powers in this game?
Yeah, so one of my other favorite just mechanisms in games is asymmetry. I love being unique in a game, having a unique special power, something that's only applied to me that only I can do. And the powers for all the characters basically break a rule of the game. So as much as I like dice rolling, there's one power that says you don't have to roll your dice, or you don't roll your dice, basically. And you just choose what value you want them to be. Others allow you to travel a little easier, and you'll get resources easier. But they're all really powerful. They're all really cool. I love playing with all of them. And just having that special ability makes the game have more variety more times you play it, and also just feels unique each time.
Yeah, I'm definitely pro asymmetry in games, so it does feel unique and different each time. I will say, however, I think the you choose what all of your dice say is a little strange, only because it's almost like you're not even playing Marco Polo anymore.
Yeah, I do agree. That's probably my least favorite one.
Right, because then you don't even care about the camels to change your pips. You're not rolling. You're not figuring out what to do with it. So, I mean, it's fine. It makes sense to have that. And what are your thoughts on the balance of these different people? Because I know one of them is overpowered.
I'm curious which one you think that is. I think they're relatively balanced. They all specialize in something different. So the last game I played, and I should say I've only played the base game Marco Polo. I haven't played the expansion or the Marco Polo 2 that just came out.
Right.
The one I played with last was the one that had two people that you can travel with. So I was able to put down more outposts, and that just gave me more beginning of round bonuses and more action spaces that I could put my dice. So I did really well in that game, being able to travel more, because traveling is super tight in this game and it's sort of expensive. So being able to travel easier was super helpful.
Right, because there's the top half of the map where you're kind of going and making outposts or raising tents or whatever.
Yeah, you're throwing some tents down to get those sort of ticket to ride-esque like cards, that route cards that you want to fulfill. And also having a trading outpost down on one of the major cities gives you an action that only you can do, or whoever has an outpost there at that city can take.
Right. And I think I'm remembering one of the other player powers is basically that there are kind of portals up in that section, and you can kind of like plop through the ground and show up another place, right?
Yeah, that's the prairie dog. I think it's the oasis. I think there's oases. So there's major cities on the board, but then also there's spots between those called oases. And one of the characters is allowed to basically move to another spot, an oasis spot across the board as if it were adjacent. So you can really bounce around and put those trading outposts down a lot easier.
Mm-hmm. All right, you want to know which person I think is overpowered?
Yeah, I'm curious.
And I'm not the only person who thinks this. The guys from the Game Brain podcast say that this person is overpowered, and they even said that the online community feels that this power is overpowered.
Actually, can I guess before you say it?
Please.
Is it the one that you don't have to pay to place your die?
No.
Okay.
It is the one that gets bonuses from the market when everyone goes to the market.
Oh.
The one where, like, if you go and get X good, I also get one of them. I think it worked like that, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so whatever good you get one of them. You get, you know, I'll throw you one silk for going to the silk market.
Yeah, exactly.
That one, yeah, it is super powerful because you don't have to go to the market yourself most of the time. But I've also been in games where the market didn't get used that much, and you didn't get as much benefit as you normally did. So maybe that put a weird taste in my mouth.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, getting free resources is always a good thing in any game without doing anything.
Right. Any game with resource management, it's great when you get a free resource.
Right. And that character has a few different versions of them. So no matter what player count you're doing, whether it's 2, 3, or 4.
Right, it scales.
So it scales a little bit, yeah. But, you know, in a two-player game, though, and that's what I usually have been playing mostly these days, you know, I don't think you get as much out of it because there's only two of you. And if the one person doesn't go to the market that much, then, you know, it's not as beneficial. But, yes, yeah, still super overpowered to get free resources all the time.
Right, yeah. I remember I played this, and I played it more than once, but a recent play was with Nick. And Nick had that person, and he just got so many points and like contracts fulfilled because he had that person. And it just like became abundantly clear in our game, at least, that if the market is being used and that character is in it, it's like they're guaranteed to win.
Yeah, no, I believe it. And you brought up another aspect of the game that I really enjoy was the contract fulfillment. The resources that you get, like you said, go to your contract fulfillment, and then those contracts usually give you more resources, so you can kind of chain contracts together. And just in any game, I like fulfilling contracts. It's just like a little win almost, even if you're doing terrible at the game, or you know, you're not in it, being able to just complete something just feels nice. Like, oh yeah, I did something, I fulfilled, you know, 5 contracts this game, you know, look at me. Yeah. It's just those little wins throughout the game sort of add up.
Definitely. I think that's, you know, I have come to realize that one thing that I love about Clans of Caledonia is the contract fulfillment, and it has made me kind of search out contract fulfillment in a lot of other games. And I just want to echo exactly what you said. You know, no matter how poorly you're doing, if you can finish a contract, you're going to feel good. You know, I might be getting last place, but I accomplished some things. And it kind of feels like a little victory every other round as well. Like, it really keeps you kind of positive and engaged. So, you know, maybe I'm not shooting for the victory, but hey, let me go try and fulfill that contract.
Yeah, it's just satisfying to fulfill something that you were, you know, you're headed towards, or you were trying to accomplish.
Right. Because normally you start a board game and your goal is to win. But now you can have like 7 other goals that you can accomplish and you're fine.
Yeah, and you'll probably get a couple points and maybe you might be in the running after all.
That's right.
And, you know, the other point about this game is the worker placement aspect. I think that's why I like it so much, because it has all of the stuff I like just thrown into one game, with the dice rolling, the dice manipulation, the asymmetry, the contract fulfillment, and then also the other mechanic that I love is worker placement. And you're essentially using your die as workers, I guess, to go to those action spaces and take those actions. And, you know, even though you're not necessarily doing any blocking in this game, because a majority of the spaces you can still go to if I went there, except you just have to pay, you have to pay some money probably.
Or you have to spend a higher pip die, right, on the bottom left action?
Yeah, the bottom left one where you're sort of going in order. If someone puts a 3 down, it has to be a 3 or greater to take that action. But the normal action spaces, if I go first, say I'm getting some silk, and I use a 4, and you come over and you want some silk too, you can go on top of my die, but you have to pay whatever your pip value is, just as a penalty for me getting there first, basically. You can still take the action, but you have to pay something for it. And I like that aspect where you're not really blocking. They can still do it, but they just have to give up something.
Right. And another thing that I think this game does really well and makes an interesting design decision on is how turn order is selected round to round. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So going back to travel, how expensive it is. If you want to move 4 spots, you have to pay a hefty chunk of change. And the spot for traveling, I think it takes 2 die. And whoever is last, so I guess whoever's on top at the end of the round, whoever traveled last, basically, gets to be first player the next round. So it's a little game of chicken of, you know, that spot is open. I don't have to pay, because remember the die going on top of another person's die, you have to pay for that penalty, and then also the payment for traveling itself. So if I went first, I'm probably not going to go first the next round, but I still get that advantage of not having to pay a penalty for someone already there.
Right. Yeah. I always like when games have an interesting turn order mechanic between rounds instead of just, okay, you go first and go clockwise until the game ends.
Right. Yeah. Having just, yeah, something else to do. Like, okay, I'm not doing well this round. I kind of had to pay a couple penalties, but if I can go first next round, then maybe something can happen. And having that sort of side goal to aim for, just, yeah, it adds something to the game, not just going around and around, like you said.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you brought up the dice as worker placement, and I believe that was your choice for mechanic of the week as well, right?
Yeah, that is. It flows nicely, almost as if we planned it this way.
Wow. So why don't you tell us a little more about the mechanic itself? Because I think it's used differently in some games.
Right, so...
Let me just turn my note sheet, he says.
Yeah, that's right, yeah, as you hear my notebook. No, I can just explain it without it. The dice placement is basically worker placement, but the pip value might determine which actions you can take or how powerful those actions you can take. And one of the things I like about rolling die in the beginning of a round and having those different options is that every round is literally different. I mean, it's sort of a mini game within a game, because Marco Polo has all this variety, whether it's different character or different action spaces. You shuffle those up and deal some at the beginning of the game. So that's always different. The contracts are always different. So not only do you have this umbrella of variety in the game itself, but every turn you're rolling your die and you're going to get a different number or different values every time. Mm-hmm. So that's different. And that always dictates what you want to do that round. So it's not always going around and around. You have six workers each round. You just keep going back and forth, placing them. You have to decide, okay, where do I get the best value from my two this round? Or, you know, I have a six. Do I want to spend it over here, or do I want to save it for something more powerful? You know, it really adds variety and strategic decision-making each and every round.
Yeah, definitely. One thing that I think is really neat about this mechanic is I don't want to say it's a stepping stone, but it's kind of like the in-between of standard worker placement and worker placement with different types of workers. Because this shows you, you know, sure, you can just have a bunch of bland workers, but like you're saying, maybe you'll have a 1, a 2, a 3, a 4, and you have to figure out how to use each one the best. So it's kind of a great advanced worker placement idea.
Yeah. And just going back to magic, actually, the concept of variance, and I know one of the lead designers for magic, Mark Rosewater, I think he had an article on variance too. It's basically how differently a gameplay element plays out from one play experience to the next. And that is just brought to the round level in this game. So there's mm-hmm. high variance every round, because it's going to play differently. It's not the same workers each round. It's completely different. And the ability to control that randomness and sort of plan for that randomness too is really attractive, where you can store up camels to manipulate the die on a poor roll or re-roll a die. And, you know, normally on a dice game, if you roll and you have no control over it, it just feels bad if you had a poor outcome. If you had a poor outcome in Marco Polo, that's not necessarily a bad thing, because you can still get some benefit of placing your lower rolls somewhere, and you get something out of it. But you still have that ability to manipulate those dice and make them powerful based off of previous planning from the game.
Yeah, definitely. And what are some other games that use worker placement with dice workers that you... like?
It's actually one of my favorite games, or starting to become one of my favorite games. I've only played it a couple of times. Is Rajahs of the Ganges? Have you guys played that?
I haven't played it because it's, well, A, I haven't had the opportunity to, but B, I think it's a colorblind person's nightmare.
That actually might be, yeah, that might be true in terms of the die, because there's no really differentiator besides the color. Yeah, so we might have to. Maybe I'll build a custom set for you, just for you, Jonah.
Yeah, please.
We'll figure something out. Have you played this, Ben, or no?
I have not. So to be honest, I'm looking through a list of dice placement games, and I've only played two of them, and one of them might not even be a dice placement game. It might be like more like a dice allocation game. So I haven't played Space Base, which I think doesn't really... It's really just dice allocation. I don't really think it's dice placement because you're just using the results. And then the other one is, which I actually didn't think of before, but Lords of Vegas, where you actually are increasing the pip value of your casinos in order to take over casinos nearby. So using your dice, you do roll your dice. So there is randomness involved. You do roll your dice to essentially try and take over neighboring casinos, but you need to have, you need to increase the pip values on your dice that you have already placed out on the board when buying plots of land. And you need to beat like a certain strength of a casino that you are increasing by raising the pip value of your dice.
Hmm.
But other than that, I'm looking through this list and I've played none of these games. So I would like to try some of them. Like, I own Claustrophobia and I'm dying to play it. And I know that that's dice placement. And the way that the systems work look really, really cool. Like, I've looked into dice placement as, like, a mechanic. And it definitely looks like something I would enjoy. I just haven't had the chance to play any of them yet. So I'm down to play them. But I've only played a couple.
Yeah, the dice allocation, I guess, could be sort of like a subcategory of it. It's relatively the same thing. But I think you guys really enjoy the Rogers of the Ganges because it's, again, it has all of my favorite aspects of the game in it. Yeah, the dice placement, the dice rolling, the dice manipulation. There's a concept of, there's like a Carcassonne sort of mini game in there too, where you're placing tiles and if you connect them to your sort of your mansion.
I've always wanted a mansion.
Yeah, you finally get a mansion. It's perfect. but what's great about actually, I guess, explain how the game works. There's two tracks along the board, and this isn't a game where the highest score wins, really. It's a race. It's basically a racing game. So going one way would be a track for money, and going the other way on the other side of the board would be a track for fame. And as you're playing the game, those tracks will increase, and when they meet, when your two markers meet on those tracks, that's when the game end is triggered. So whoever does that first generally wins, but if more people match that round, then whoever has the highest score wins. So it's a racing game, and the dice are not really workers. They're basically resources. So you never take them back to your pool every round. Like in Marco Polo, you take your dice back and then re-roll them and start the next round. You're constantly getting new die, spending die throughout the whole game, and you're using them as a resource. So if a spot needed a purple five, okay, well, you spend a purple five, and then that's going to be gone for the next round. You need another way to generate die. And whenever you get a die, you roll it. Whatever color it is, you roll it and add that to your pool to use for future actions. So it's just this fluid game of spending resource die, getting resource die, and in a worker placement style framework, basically.
Cool. I'd love to try it in the after times, of course.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm trying to play it more and more because I think I really enjoy it.
Cool. It's funny because I look at the list of games that uses mechanic, and two things. One, it's just a list of games you love, Greg. And two, when I told Patrick that you were going to be on the podcast, I said, guess the mechanic and guess the game. And do you think he got both right, or do you know he got both right?
Well, I don't know, but I assume he got both right, the way that you're talking.
Yes, he definitely got both right. It's funny because, you know, looking at this, I see, you know, Marco Polo, which you love, Teotihuacan, I know you like, Lorenzo Il Magnifico, we played together, Fantastic Factories, I know you own.
I want to try Fantastic Factories. Yeah, I always think, like, visually it just looks really cool.
That's another game, actually, I was going to talk about if we had time, but yeah, you guys would enjoy that because it has a Terraforming Mars aspect of it. It's sort of engine building, where you have these scenic cards. Yeah, and has that dice placement ability to be manipulated. So if you have a poor roll, yeah, you can spend some of your resources that you accumulated before to take some powerful actions and generate good. So it's a really light game too. I feel like it's low to medium. Like you probably can use it as an intro game.
Oh yeah, I definitely think you can. And the production value is top notch as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the boards are really solid.
Double layered as well, right?
Yeah, double layered. You know, the dice are really chunky, and so it's a nice table presence to bring it back. What we were talking about it. So, yeah. Is there actually one more thing I wanted to say about the dice? And this goes back to maybe me being such a wuss with these games and mean games. Is that?
Oh no! Don't say that.
It's the self-deprecating humor. I love it. Can't stop. It takes the pressure off, basically, or a little pressure off, because a game like Blue Chain Magnate or something that's incredibly tight and, you know, has that mean aspect to it, but it's like really elegant at the same time. And me being, I'm not like the smartest dude in the dude drawer or whatever it might be, but like my brain power has a max capacity, and some of those games really push it to the limit. With the dice, it's like, oh, it's not my fault I had a bad, like, it's the dice's fault that had a bad roll, you know? Like, I'll just do my best this round to work with what I got, basically. And I think that type of game is where I max out on my brain power, and I think that's why I enjoy them so much. It has, like, it allows for a buffer in decision making, basically.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And it definitely feels good to have to work with what you're given instead of to give yourself something to work with. Because I know playing games with Nick, something that he has commented on is, you know, he finds himself unable to plan for like other people's things, and he feels like a lot of these like bigger, grander games, you know, like Something Else Will Do Something, and he's like, oh dang it, why didn't I think of that, you know, and that's on me. But with dice placement, you don't have to think about these other things as much, you know. It's, this is what you're given, how can you use it?
Yeah, and everybody's sort of in their own, you know, own focus. It's, dare I say, multiplayer solitaire, it's sometimes, for the most part.
Right.
And I know a lot of people don't like that. You know, they love the player interaction. For me, I think I enjoy more efficiency puzzles, sort of a race to be the most efficient, or who can be the most efficient from what they got as bonus points or having asymmetry. So if we both start with different resources or a unique ability, how can we make use of that throughout the game in the most efficient way? And maybe we don't mess with each other throughout the game. It's just sort of a race to be the most efficient.
Right. You're both playing the same game, but you're not playing against each other too much.
Yeah, and maybe sort of a side dish of player interaction or meanness. Maybe you blocked a spot, or yeah, you took something that they needed or something like that. You know, that's, I love that too. I mean, but the sort of like direct super conflict games, mm-hmm. I just sometimes it rubs me the wrong way, not all the time.
All right, so what are your top three dice worker placement games, and then also your bottom one? What game does not do it well?
Oh geez, well, the top three probably are the ones we talked about: Marco Polo, Rajas of the Ganges, and probably Fantastic Factories. I think those are my top three.
I'm sure played Troyes or Trois.
Trois, yeah. I've only played that once. That is sort of a dice placement game, or I guess dice allocation. I love the ability to buy other people's die in that, though.
Yeah, exactly.
That's such a cool mechanic. But I need to play that more, though. I enjoyed it. But my least favorite, I don't know. I think. Can you get back to me on that one?
Sure. Go next time you're on the show, you can bring us that answer.
Yeah, I'll follow up offline with that one. but I think, you know, just to say, I think I enjoy that mechanic no matter what no matter what game it is in, because each, to me, each round would be another puzzle that I have to figure out.
Mm-hmm.
So even if the game was, you know, was poor or just as an overall was a bad game, I still think each round or each sort of role and placement, I would still enjoy just trying to figure that out.
Yeah, it's definitely up Ben's puzzle alley as well, I think. It's a shame he hasn't played more of them.
Yeah, like I said, I'm down to play more of them, and I would like to play more of them. I just haven't had the chance yet, so unfortunate.
The space base that you were saying, though, that's another one of my favorite games, too. Combines engine building with dice, and that's super fun.
Yeah, I love Space Base. It's quick and easy. It's a great one. My family loves it, too, which is a surprise. Usually that doesn't happen.
That, to me, that game is basically, you know, I love the gambling aspect of that. You know, it's the degenerate gambler in me where, like, all right, I'll pick a 12, you know. Chances are I'm not going to roll a 12, but when you do, I'll feel so good, you know.
Yep. I get it. I mean, that one specific card that is like, if you roll 5 12s, you win the whole game just right away.
Yeah, and that's a game where if you don't win, you probably still had fun doing it, because, you know, the dice rolling, just to go back to that, it adds variance, but also the ebb and flow of when it does work, like when you have an amazing roll, you know, that feels good, and you have a poor roll, that sucks, but it just makes the time where you do roll well that much better. You know, it's all about balance. You know, you need the bad rolls for the good rolls to feel good, and having that variance and those ebbs and flows throughout the game just keeps it exciting. And yeah, just want to play it more and more.
Yeah, the high rolls feel good, and the low rolls, even if they feel a little bad, they are just a puzzle to solve. They're not even a bad feeling.
Exactly.
I think that about does it for us today. Greg, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yep, thanks for joining.
We'll have you on another time to find out your least favorite game.
Yeah, I feel like I have homework now. So this podcast is like, I feel like I'm back in high school or something. I got to keep my head down so you don't call on me most of the time. It's like, I don't have the answer.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone, for listening. And thank you, as always, to Louisa for the great music throughout. Have a good one.